Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And we need to continue learn, pray, act. And as a matter of fact, what we're going to be covering today is probably the most important documents that we deal with on an annual basis. And I say that because these documents galvanize what the Constitution is. It galvanizes who has responsibility in holding the government accountable at the appropriate level. So it's really focused, obviously, it is focused on the federal Constitution, but this is applicable in our republic on any government formed out of a constitution, i.e. the federal, the state, and or the county, which means that those who create that constitution are the parties to it, which means they have the responsibility, which is why we go painstakingly through this process so that you understand that at the federal level, it's the states. And this is not GR telling you this. This is Thomas Jefferson and James Madison laying this out. So this is all about, these next few shows are all about this process. Now we could, and I'm looking at how many days we have left. Between now, this show, and Christmas, we have about 15 shows left. Barring some dynamic problem or something that happens that we will have to focus on separately. And let's just hope that we still have time to be able to do what needs to get done. I've been doing this for a while, and we still do not have the movement necessary to where I think, okay, this is kind of on autopilot. Lord, you can take me now. You know, hit me with that comet, what have you. But anyway, welcome back, Sean. And welcome back to probably the highlight of the show for the year. Because as much as I say the milk and honey is the ratification debates, the Constitutional Convention, you know, these other really primary source documents, these are the documents that really put everything together as to how and why we need to move forward in holding our public servants accountable at the appropriate level by the appropriate body of sovereigns. Now, that goes back to this whole form of republicanism. I don't know if you remember, we've kind of talked about what is a republican form of government. Remember that question?
Yes, sir.
So what is a republican form of government? What was the answer to that?
Where the people empowered representatives to form the government under limited, enumerated, specific roles and responsibilities to guard liberty.
Yes. Okay, that's very good. So to put it together, this is why we have bicameral legislative bodies in our government. Now, at the county level, we don't necessarily have a sub-government that needs representation at the county level, right? It's just directly we the people and our representatives. If you live in a county, it has never been done yet, and as a matter of fact, we don't even have county constitutions. But if you live in a county that has a large enough population where that county needs to be subdivided, then there's a good chance that your county should have a Senate as well as a House of Representatives, which means that you would create a smaller subset government, like a district in your county, and that the district is where you would, you know, you, we the people, would create that government that would then create the county government. That makes sense, right? We'd put a new step in it.
Yes, sir.
Okay. There we go. So that way we at least always maintain a cognitive sovereignty over those representatives who have that authority of governing our everyday lives. You know, we're going to put a stop sign here. We're going to take the stop sign down and put a light here. And so that way you can, no. And, you know, and you actually can hold people directly accountable. We want to make sure that this is where the decisions are being made. What is going to happen with your health care? Are you going to have a free market health care system? Or are you going to let the county kind of create a health care system for you? Services, EMT services, ambulatory services. Or do you want that to be done by the hospitals? Anyway, this is where you actually have to be far more involved in what your government is going to do for you. At the state level, it would be, you know, okay, so it needs to be able to support the counties and kind of like the federal government, more of a general government. So I don't want to go through the makeup of constitutions, but bottom line, we kind of start seeing that this government that we have is a, it's a shared, when once you step up beyond your local government, it becomes a shared government between the people and that local government that they've created or that state government that they've created. So it's shared. We have this shared sovereignty and responsibility. So anyway, what we're doing is we're diving into the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions. And in so doing, we kind of covered this already. The Kentucky resolutions of 1798 and 1799 were written by Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson really does call out that we need to nullify these laws. Now, when he's calling out the need for nullification, he's doing this in a call of interposition. Unfortunately, he doesn't say this. And unfortunately, he really holds this hard line. And so what ends up happening, and you kind of have to put everything together between this resolution, the 1799 resolution, to see what is it that they really did. And we can get into that conclusion once we hit the 1799 resolutions. I don't like, you know, turning the book over and reading the last couple of pages. So we'll get into that. But at this point in time, I kind of told you that what Jefferson does and what you have to do is you kind of have to audit the Constitution or audit, you have to generalize at least the Constitution, the form of government. And then what you do is you look at the laws that are being passed or being executed, that are, what is being done, and then you contrast that to the powers delegated. If the, what's being done is not within those delegated powers, then you have a responsibility to identify how, why, what they're doing, whether they're not delegated, they're not within this or that. So this is how you basically lay out a petition. Technically, these resolutions were petitions to the other states. They were basically saying, resolve, and they were making these comments. And then as they went down at the very bottom, they basically said, now we're calling upon you, resolve, that you need to join us. They could have easily done whereas, therefore. Easily done that. And as a matter of fact, I think when you get to that point where you actually start calling upon the other governments, I think it would be okay to kind of fold it all together with resolutions as well as whereases and then therefores, if that makes sense. But we can do that when we actually get enough, you know, when we get our county to actually create the Constitution Compliance Committee and when they start creating the endorsements to the petition. So let me just, because I do want to focus on what we're doing right now. We have petitions already that call for the government violations and what needs to be done, that all these petitions are pointing to our county legislators, and that what we expect these county legislators to do is to create this Constitutional Compliance Committee. That's job one. The second thing we ask them to do is to endorse this committee. Instead of creating a petition itself, they don't need to. In other words, they don't need to do the resolutions of the petitions at the county level. All they need to do is just take the petition that we've created and create a cover sheet with, they could use a resolution. Resolved that we've examined this resolution and we cannot refute it. Therefore, we are endorsing this petition. I call it a resolution, sorry, but if we endorse this petition and we're forwarding it to every county in this state, calling upon you to turn to this page and, you know, read this petition and then turn to this page as to what you need to do. And then help everybody understand that there are these steps. You have to create this committee. You got to endorse it, send it out. So in other words, what we do is with one petition is we create like a catalyst, a spark that starts spread. It initiates out of one county and it quickly spreads to all the counties immediately. And those counties that are in the right paradigm, they're going to receive this, they're going to get it, and they're going to start doing what needs to be done. There'll be those counties that won't do it first off. They'll go, what the heck? They'll ask questions because maybe they're ignorant, whatever. They'll come along and they'll go along with it. There are those other counties that will look at this as a real threat, and they'll probably go to the state and go, do you see what they're doing? They're organizing against us. And there's nothing they can do about it. There is nothing they can do about it. So, and as a matter of fact, there's, I won't dive into it at this point in time. Let me just say this, that as we go through this, what we're going to notice in the very first resolution is where Jefferson kind of forms this summary of the Constitution of the federal government. So with that, Sean, if you would be, I know there's some latency, so when I interrupt you, you may be continuing to read, but that's okay. I get that. That's just the nature of the communications we have. But as you go ahead and go through this, what I want to do is I want to kind of stop and help kind of explain, especially in this very first compacted summarization of the government and its relationship with the states, if you wouldn't mind. So go ahead and start with the first resolution.
Resolved that the several states composing the United States of America are not united on the principle of unlimited submission to their general government, but that by a compact under the style and title of a Constitution for the United States and of amendments thereto.
Right there. If you could stop right there. So what he just said, I want to help everybody kind of understand how he's going through this. He's basically laying out that the states composing the United States of America are not united on that principle of an unlimited submission to a general government. Just so you understand, when the states join the Union, they are not joining the federal government. They are, because the federal government is the creature of the compact. It is not an entity that has the authority to create a one-to-one relationship with the state. It has a one-to-many relationship with the states, just like the state joining has a one-to-many with the states as well. Its job is to interface with the creature's job is to interface with the Union on equal footing, equal basis, because they're all equal sovereigns. And so what he basically is laying out, that this compact that they've created has created this creature, but they're joining into this one to the Union, to their fellow states, under this thing called the Constitution. Go ahead.
They constituted a general government for special purposes, delegated to that government certain definite powers, reserving each state to itself the residuary mass of right to their own self-government.
Self-explanatory. Go ahead.
And that whensoever the general government assumes undelegated powers, its acts are authoritative, void, and of no force. That to this compact each state acceded as a state, as an integral part, its co-states forming as to itself the other party. That the government created by this compact was not made the exclusive or final judge of the extent of the powers delegated to itself, since that would have made its discretion and not the Constitution. the measure of its powers.
Okay, right there. But you had no idea I was going to interrupt you because this is not highlighted. What I want to do is I want to need to stitch what you just said together so that when the federal government assumes power not delegated, he lays out this thing that basically they've done something that is void with no force. When you do something without the authority, it's not legitimate. It is void of no force. That under this compact, he again goes back to this concept that the states forming to itself and to the other parties, they've created this compact that they are the basically, you know, they are the parties to it. They are the authors and the final arbiters. And that it did not make the federal government the exclusive or final judge to the extents of their powers. The states determine what those extents are or if they've gone beyond their powers. Therefore, if they would have actually given that kind of power to the federal government, then it would be literally a general power. We talk about general and defined powers. They have defined powers. Giving them general powers gives it to them to their discretion to do whatever they want. We do not have that kind of government. We have a limited and defined, and this is why at this juncture I usually help people understand that we have powers of attorney in our constitutions are nothing but powers of attorney documents, where we create a government and we authorize it, very limited and defined powers. So in other words, we have a limited and defined power of attorney. We never give them general powers. We went through the ratification debates. It was clearly laid out. No general powers were delegated. Now the last part of the resolution. Go ahead. As in all other cases.
Since that would have made its discretion and not the Constitution the measure of its powers. But that, as in all other cases of compact among powers having no common judge, each party has an equal right to judge for itself, as well of infractions as of the mode and measure of redress.
Okay, so right here, Jefferson kind of lays out this concept that the parties themselves have a responsibility to make some decisions very quickly. However, on top of that, each member, each party to the compact, in other words, each of the states actually has the authorization or the ability, because they are an individual party in the compact, they can make for themselves a decision to say, you know what, this is definitely not what we signed on for, and we're out of here because we believe that this completely changes everything. And we are no longer obligated because this government has defied its limitations and it's now exercising powers it doesn't have. We're not going to stand around for this. We're leaving. So, in other words, he's laying out that there's literally, at this point in time, when the federal government makes an encroachment, a violation, they do something that they don't have the authority to do and assume a power. At that point in time, each state has basically a decision to make where they can either do one or of two things. They can call upon the states to say, we've got to pull this federal government back into compliance. Or they could say, that's it, we're done. This is so material, this is so egregious, we are out of here. There you go. Now, see, that was, so Sean, when we look at what happened with the southern states really didn't have an option because they knew that the sentiment of the northern states was greater than the southern states. That's why when we looked at the difference between the northern states and the southern states, the numbers were significantly greater for the north than there was for the south. I'm not sure if you ever knew what that was and so forth. But anyway, as we lay this out, I'm hoping that you can kind of see with the south, the numbers were so obviously against them that they couldn't call upon the other states to say, hey, look, you guys are violating the Constitution. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Okay, because they were the ones driving the federal government into basically endorsing or pushing economic warfare against the southern states. And so their existence in the Union was basically, they didn't have two choices. They couldn't stand up and say, hey, you guys are doing the wrong thing. Because when it comes to power not delegated, we get into this down the road, the ultimate tribunal is the states themselves. So if they pulled out and said, hey, hold on here, we need to come together as states to deal with what the federal government is doing, and you already see that the northern states are the bad actors in driving the federal government, you're dealing with a biased court, a court that will rule against you because they're bloodthirsty. They are out to get rid of your slavery. And the southern states were so adamant in maintaining slavery, they began leaving the Union for slavery. There were four states that actually got the secessions notices. They basically provided secession. We're out of here. At that point in time, I believe Lincoln basically suspended Congress so that no other state could technically leave the Union. And so, and then he started basically exercising unconstitutional powers himself. I mean, the North was so arrogant with their indignant power that there was nothing stopping them from stopping slavery. And I'm not trying to sound like an advocate for slavery here. I'm basically saying that the South had no other option. The interesting thing was that if you really look at this, and I think anybody that examines what happened after the Civil War, the Southern states would not have ever come back into the Union if it wasn't for the 14th Amendment. Do you know why? It's okay if you don't know why. We probably covered this, but it's the fourth section of the 14th Amendment. The fourth section alleviated any debt to any state in the Union to any foreign nation that paid for the rebellion. So in other words, those southern states could actually, you know, just sit there and languish under that debt and be crushed, and it would have given them a footstool, or I should say it would have given Britain a footstool to come in and literally, you know, pull these states underneath them. That would have been really a dangerous, I would think it would be a dangerous measure for Britain, because had they allowed Britain to come in, do you think Britain would have allowed slavery to continue?
No, but they wouldn't have had a choice in it then. They couldn't have said, oh, we're leaving the Union, because then they would have sent the army in and enforced whatever it is the king wanted.
Right. So actually Britain, while we were fighting the Civil War, Britain basically ended slavery in Britain itself. So Britain was basically, you know, supporting slavery in this microcosm in the world where they were actually laying things out to say, you know, we're not going to be a part of this anymore. So they kind of took this commitment. So if the South would have won the Civil War, or the, you know, we got to a point where, you know, we ended up, the all aggression stopped, we came to peace. The intent was to bring those states back. We had to motivate them to bring them back. And the money was the motivation, because we're talking about millions, if not possibly $1 billion. It was a high number. I have no idea what it was, but it was a high number that they owed Britain. Now, if they said, you know what, we're not going to come back into the Union. You know, you can create your 14th Amendment, you can do all of these things, and you can occupy us, but we're not coming back in, and we're going to turn to these nations that have given us money to say, hey, you know, they may have beaten us, but we don't want to go back into the Union. Now, we're going into a break, so when we come back from a break, I'll kind of sew this up, because they had no other choice but to come back into the Union, because Britain would have had nothing but problems, and we'll talk about, I'll give you that right there, why they just had no other choice, so that, you know, you can put a contrast between the petitions and what happened between the Civil War with nullification and this. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so to make this as simple as possible, had they basically put up, we're not going to come back into the union, and we're not going to allow you to own us anymore. They didn't have any choice because Britain did not have the ability to come in and allow them to maintain and defend their slavery. And there would have been a whole army, we're talking millions of slaves, that were being freed by the North. I mean, Britain was walking into a buzzsaw. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so there was no way Britain could have gotten themselves in the middle of this. So to basically sweeten the pot and actually to punish Britain for spending money in our little, you know, basically going on the Monroe Doctrine, in our sphere of the world, for them to spend money to undermine our Constitution in supporting this insurrection or supporting the Civil War, that the South Side, right, wrong, or indifferent, the fact that they threw all of that money, basically they said, okay, we're going to punish you, and the way we're going to punish you is we're going to help motivate these states to not pay you, to come back into the Union, so that you get basically nada. And that's why Section 4 was a very powerful motivation in basically pulling the Union back together, because it worked. And as a matter of fact, you can see Britain then had to reach deeper into their pockets. This goes back to, you've heard me say, that King George, you know, a half a century, a little over a half a century more, almost a century technically, King George, when he made the decision to not give us representation in Parliament and to basically say, to heck with you, you are just going to be, you know, a footstool for us. That was the worst business decision for a country ever, because it didn't just cost them so much money and so many losses. At that point in time, in that first revolution, they lost again in the second revolution of the War of 1812. And then they lost again in the Civil War. Almost $1 billion. I mean, we're talking, this has been, you know, this thing that they just couldn't get, let it go. Just let it go. Either give us what we want or let it go. No way. They were committed to basically destroy themselves financially. Does that make sense?
And, yes, it does.
And that's why we should never allow our emotions drive business decisions. But that's exactly what happened. And so then again, Britain then turned to their, you know, their pockets, their gold in their pockets, and they started bringing money into America. And the way they succeeded was they corrupted us through our legal system. They corrupted our politicians. So our political system and our legal system got corrupted by Britain by pouring money into our elections and then slowly but surely using money to corrupt our top end of our government. In so doing, it made us vulnerable towards the end of the 1800s to allow the Fabian Society, while we were reconfiguring things like our education system, it even made us more vulnerable. So even though we did the right thing and we did good things, because the government was already doing things that it shouldn't have been doing. It just made us more vulnerable when that corruption occurred that nobody really noticed. Well, shoot, the government's been doing these things for a while. They already started this education system. They've already been playing in socialized healthcare and you know, in engineering and getting involved in corporations, things that they should never have been doing. So I think that that was one of the reasons why we, the people, never realized what was going on, and maybe very few people in the state government or lower governments realized how bad it was until all of a sudden everybody started realizing that the federal courts were literally coming up with more and more egregious, going away from these fundamental principles of the Constitution and so forth. Even though they were already corrupt, like when the Taneys, you know, created the law that blacks could not be citizens, you know, that was a law created by the Supreme Court. It was unconstitutional. So the courts were already doing things that they had no authority to do. That's my whole point, that when Britain did take over, they were already taking over what was a corrupt system, but it was corrupt for, I'll use the term, noble purposes. In other words, for, you know, right, wrong, or indifferent, when, you know, some people say we need to have slavery and it's the Christian thing to do, they're doing that in a with a bad paradigm, but they're doing that with these noble intents. That makes sense, right?
So I wouldn't say it makes sense, but I understand.
Okay, yeah. So, but there's a difference to, you know, doing something to give you a different outcome. Preserving a bad paradigm is still what I would classify as these people still believed in what they were doing. These other things that started coming in to basically change and start basically pushing America towards this communist global government. And so in so doing, we kind of talked about this the other day when we talked about Jerusalem, that it was only the next step of basically corrupting America even further by getting and creating national corporations, not public corporations that are under the federal government like we had with Britain, or like Britain had. These were private corporations that were nationalized by the federal government because the federal government came in and said, we're now regulating you and you can now operate in between states with, you know, immunity. The states can't do anything to you anymore. And we're seizing control of all of this, basically opening the door to flood by creating these corrupt corporations to flood the world with a, you know, this newfound independent monarchs. Because as these corporations grew, their influence over world governments started taking over. And so this is why we see how the globalist is both in the beds with the banking, it's in bed with the corporations, and it's in bed with governments. It is the ultimate, when you look at corruption, you know, to the nth degree, that's what we have today.
Oligarchy.
Yes, and or even in so many different levels, right? You've got this oligarchy level that protects the lower levels. There are those that are... you've seen the Black Eye Club and all of that. Who really is in control? Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it's got so many different layers, but it is this grand scheme that was designed and laid out and was constantly going through improvements, this innovation and improvements to make it better and harder to get away from. This is why when we talk, and I didn't mean to get into this, you know, and get away from this, but this is why when we talk about this next catastrophic financial event, it is going to challenge the Constitution to its core. If the states, if your state legislatures are still clueless and illiterate, they will get through this final barrier of the Constitution and we're doomed. This is why this is so important, what we're covering. and giving you some history and understanding that at this point in time, there is no option of seceding. We need every state. This is why I kind of went down this, swam this Olympic pool regarding the Civil War and the fact that they had no decision to make. We don't have a decision to make now either. We can't secede. If the states try to secede, they will be foiled in that effort because not enough of them will secede, and they will be brought into the fold with force. The only way to do this is to do this without force. We will win if we choose not to use deadly force by actually getting the states to quickly bond together and say, look, this is our Constitution. You don't have the authority to do that. And by the way, you don't have the authority to create that debt. And actually, this is where we can literally wipe the slate clean, get rid of all these corrupt people very quickly. We can do this very quickly. The only force necessary would actually be applied to the corrupt politicians, bankers, corporations, and so forth. Period. This is how the only way we can do this is actually to allow America to basically reunite itself and heal itself from this corrupt leadership and these corrupt paradigms that have been rammed down our throat. So all that being said, now Jefferson in the second resolution is going to start going through these different acts and so forth. But before he does that, this next resolution, he dives into this concept of law and delegation of crimes to the federal government before he actually gets in. So third is where he actually gets into the actual acts themselves. This is where he points out the limitation of the federal government to even create a law and a crime. That even those things, laws and crimes, i.e. treaties and so, or not treaties, but a treason and counterfeiting. He points out that the federal government only has jurisdiction over four crimes. And then he lays this out that if they're going to have a jurisdiction over these types of crimes, we would have to amend the Constitution. So with that overview, let's go ahead and dive into the second resolution. Go ahead.
Number two, resolved that the Constitution of the United States, having delegated to Congress a power to punish treason, counterfeiting the securities and current coin of the United States, piracies and felonies committed on the high seas, and offenses against the law of nations, and no other crimes whatsoever, and it being true as a general principle, and one of the amendments to the Constitution having also declared that the power is not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, not prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively, or to the people. Therefore, the Act of Congress passed on the 14th day of July, 1798, and entitled an act in addition to the act intitulated an act for the punishment of certain crimes against the United States, as also the act passed by them on the day of June, 1798, entitled an act to punish frauds committed on the Bank of the United States, and all other acts which assume to create, define, or punish crimes other than those so enumerated in the Constitution are altogether void and of no force, and that the power to create, define, and punish such other crimes is reserved and of right appertains solely and exclusively to the respective states, each within its own territory.
Okay, so right there, he basically lays out, you don't have the authority to create this new crime. You can only define and punish these four crimes. Therefore, the crimes you're creating in these acts are not within your authority, period. Okay, so now he goes into each of these and how each of these violates each of these acts and how they directly violate different parts of the Constitution, whether it be an amendment or the Constitution itself or what have you. So this is where he's really conducting the audit on the acts or those four laws that Congress had just passed called the Alien and Sedition Acts. So go ahead and pick up Resolution 3.
3. Resolved that it is true as general principle and is also expressly declared by one of the amendments to the Constitution that the power is not delegated to the United States by the Constitution or prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people, and that no power over the freedom of religion, freedom of speech, or freedom of the press being delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, all lawful powers respecting the same did of right remain, and were reserved to the states or the people, that thus was manifested their determination to retain to themselves the right of judging how far the licentiousness of speech and of the press may be abridged without lessening their useful freedom, and how far those abuses which cannot be separated from their use should be tolerated, rather than the use be destroyed.
Okay.
And thus also...
So at this point, he's really laid it out. That's why this is all highlighted. I could go through and literally highlight every part of this resolve. But this is where he really laid it out that, I mean, these are ultimately basically abridging the speech of people. This is why I kind of explained this in the forum here. This is why I believe Thomas Jefferson and James Madison actually took a stand to basically guard and protect the liberties of the people. The government was literally stealing the property of the people. In a big way, that kind of happened in a macro view that happened with the bank, but it wasn't in a direct assault towards the people's individual liberties. It was an assault against the Constitution, but not against the people. So if you really think about this, I just want you to, before you go finishing the rest of this resolve, I want you to think, folks, that here's Madison and Jefferson being superheroes. It's like they put on capes and so forth to say, we're not going to allow you to touch these good citizens. Does that make sense, Sean?
It does.
And so,
I wish people would have listened to him.
Yeah, but so it's correct. I mean, that's what it's sad enough that it got to this point. I believe that had they pulled this in 1791 with the Assumption Act, or 1790 with the Assumption Act, I think they wouldn't have had to do this now, because I think it would have helped everybody fix the paradigm that, hey, there's this process of holding the federal government accountable. We need to do that, because there was still a level of jealousy because the corruption really hadn't started trickling down. Hamilton's money hadn't started hitting the states yet. Once Hamilton's money started hitting the states, once the Assumption Act and Bank Act passed, this is how he corrupted them. And so I think these guys, realized that this was the last straw, but in this manner, it was too late. Well, I will just say it was too late to get the states to do the right thing. But these superheroes didn't die, or they didn't go away, because they weren't successful with these resolutions. Keep that in mind as well. They actually said, okay, if we can't get the states to do this, then we have to put it on our shoulders and do it. And they did. So go ahead, and let's keep going through this, rip through this out.
And thus also they guarded against all abridgment by the United States of the freedom of all religious opinions and exercises, and retained to themselves the right of protecting the same. As this state, by a law passed on the general demand of its citizens, had already protected them from all human restraint or interference, and that in addition to this general principle and express declaration, another and more special provision has been made by one of the amendments to the Constitution, which expressly declares that the Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, thereby guarding in the same sentence and under the same words the freedom of religion, of speech, and of the press, insomuch that whatever violated either throws down the sanctuary which covers the others, arid the libels, falsehood, and defamation. Equally with heresy and false religion, are withheld from the cognizance of federal tribunals, that therefore the Act of the Congress of the United States passed on the 14th day of July 1798, entitled an act in addition to the act entitled an act for the punishment of certain crimes against the United States, which does abridge the freedom of the press, is not law, but is altogether void and of no force.
Okay, so one of the things that's worth pointing out, and I just actually highlighted it, because equally with heresy and false religion are withheld from the cognizance of the federal tribunals. He's laying out that the reason why these things are withheld from them is because they can easily come down and actually start doing other things. And so when they start abridging the right of the press, the right of the speech, they can actually start assuming, this kind of goes down with the cod fishery bounties. And I know that's kind of near and dear to your heart, because it is an excellent example of how when you allow one breach to occur, these other breaches follow. And this is Jefferson's way of laying out how this, by letting them control political speech by the press and by individuals, as well as, and we get into these laws of foreigners coming in and so forth. In other words, we're going to get into immigration and the importation of people, because that has something to do with this as well, out of these four acts. And he's pointing out that by allowing this to happen, that gives the, it creates this break in this parchment, this constitutional barrier that will down the road allow them to do these other things. So that makes sense, right? Because Madison made that...
Yes, sir. It's like water.
Yeah.
Once it starts getting in, it's going to get wherever it can.
You know what? And water is so powerful. Look at the damage of of erosion that it does with rock.
Right.
So...
it all starts with one little drop.
Yeah. So Madison... do you see the parallel of the cod fishery bounties and how Madison laid it out and how Jefferson's laying it out right here as well? So... anyway, let's go into the fourth resolution, because this is where they get into, well, actually it's the fifth resolution, where they get into the importation, migration of people and so forth. So let's go through this fourth resolution, and then when we get to the fifth resolution, we'll be in some good meat as well. Go ahead.
Resolved that alien friends are under the jurisdiction and protection of the laws of the state wherein they are, that no power over them has been delegated to the United States, nor prohibited to the individual states, distinct from their power over citizens. And it being true as a general principle, and one of the amendments to the Constitution having also declared that the power is not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively, or to the people. The Act of Congress of the United States passed on July 1798, entitled an act concerning aliens, which assumes power over alien friends, not delegated by the Constitution, is not law, but is altogether void and of no force.
Okay, so you see how this sets the stage for the following one. This is where he basically lays out the jurisdiction over people that are being immigrating, people immigrating into states, people that are being imported into states. They don't have any jurisdiction over them, right? You saw that. Now, as you read this and you understand what's going on with the invasion, I understand why some people would be very apprehensive, because of the way things are. Let me ask you this, because, well, we have 3 minutes, so we're going to wrap up on this, and when we get back together tomorrow, we'll have Tammy with us. I'll wrap up with this, these thoughts on within 3 minutes, that the federal government has no constitutional authority to manage and decide who is to migrate into the states. So in other words, they don't have the ability to say, we have to bring in people from all different nations. If a state wants to actually stack their deck with very educated, highly educated people. That doesn't even matter if it's a racial issue. Doesn't even matter if it's a gender issue. The states have the right to do that. Now, I believe that there would probably not be an amendment to the Constitution to give the federal government the power to immigrate, even with the problems today, because they've proven that they became the real problem of immigration by opening the doors to culturally destroy us. So it proves that we can't trust them. So what we have to do is we have to look at how the states can actually create a system that would protect the union from bad states. How many bad states are there? How many states are there that are on a southern border that actually allows, you know, because it's a federal government, they're allowing this to be a porous and open border? The federal government's job is to seal that border and say none shall pass unless you have authority to come in. So in so doing, I believe that there's no way the states will actually be able to, you know, pass an amendment to give the states the authority to bring in hostile cultures and hostile immigrants. In other words, people that will not assimilate, you know, that won't take the language or anything else, or they're going to have to create laws that says you have those types of people in your state, in the state of California, in the state of New Mexico. You know, these you've allowed the drug cartels and all these people to get set up there. They will not be allowed to actually come in. And I believe that the states would then, the majority of the union, the majority of the states would then require that the federal government put a basically checks and points on the boundaries of these states because they're allowing these people. I believe that what would end up happening is that there would need to be an amendment to basically say these types of people that come in that are invaders must be repelled. Because what would happen is if California understood that they had the power, they'd just say, okay, we're just going to let people come in. No, so we actually have to have a standard of who the states will allow in. Does that make sense? In other words, the states will need to literally come into an agreement of how they're to manage their own immigration. Because once people get in, it gets really hard, legitimately get in, it gets really hard if they're bad actors to keep track of them. You know what I'm saying? It's just like they get into the woodwork, if you know what I mean. Any comments? Any comments on what I just said? As we see,
no, sir.
Okay. Folks, the states do have the authority over all of this. The states need to pull this back because it's only been proven that the federal government's weaponized our borders and has been using and calling them to come forth. The State Department has been integral in basically sending notifications out to these Latino states below us to basically say, if you get here, we'll allow you to stay. That right there was treason. All of those people that did that, and that actually needs to be investigated because those people need to be hanged for treason. We have to start holding people accountable, but we also have to live the rule of law. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic. We need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.